Welcome to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Every week, Federal News Radio interviews the CIOs of federal agencies about the latest directives, IT challenges, and successes. Now here's your host, Jason Miller.
My special guest today is Jerry Horton, the U.S. Agency for International Development Chief Information Officer. In fact, Jerry, this is a return engagement for you, so welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me back. I know it's been a little while.
Almost 3 years since you were last on the show, so we got to catch up on a couple priorities that's been going on since the last 3 years. You mentioned at that time you were improving USAID's network for the Foreign Service officers. So I got to ask the question, how's it going?
It's actually going really, really well. I mean, we've made some major philosophical changes. One of the things that we decided upon when I first got to AID was start to eliminate what we call AIDNet, our internal hardware network infrastructure, in light of moving more towards the internet or more towards other networks, basically making our applications, our services available from any network at any time, anywhere in the world.
Which sounds like the cloud.
Very much so, actually. The cloud is a huge piece of this, as is virtualization, as is a number of other technologies that we started looking at. We revolve it around mobility, the ability for a person to have a tablet, a smartphone, a laptop, even a desktop in a foreign location to be able to access our network infrastructure remotely, safely, securely, but easily. You know, a lot of times the network becomes very, very difficult to use because it's kind of old or it's just cranky or it's just, you know, just not easy to use. And what we're really trying to do is make it very, very easy for our folks.
Now, have you been able to turn off or at least change AIDNet? So where maybe at one time it was very local centric, now it's more of a wide area network. What kind of changes have you been able to do?
Again, what we're trying to do is push our applications and services more towards the cloud or towards virtualization. It gives us the opportunity to start to turn it off. We're also in a major consolidation effort with the State Department, since they have to have a network infrastructure around the world. It gives us the opportunity to basically start to eliminate hours. So we're doing that in three posts, and it's just 5 seconds.
That's incredible. I mean, the fact is that you can kind of start turning things off. Now, how much are you using state's network versus your own network? Or is it, you kind of look at each situation, each camp or post or station and say, okay, that we can use ours, or that one will ride on state's network?
What we're trying to head to is the fact that it'll work on any network. The fact that it runs over state's network and it already exists there, you know, from our perspective, a network infrastructure is becoming a commodity. With the internet so available, so easy to access, whether we use the internet for our access or we use the State Department or anyone else, doesn't really matter.
But at the same time, though, you have to deal with people with poor internet connections in certain countries. Maybe they rely on satellite. Maybe it's electricity that comes and goes. How do you prepare for that too?
Well, in a couple of different situations. One is that we're moving our data center at a facility right near the point of presence for all the major network infrastructures coming into the U.S. So basically, it eliminates a lot of the latency, a lot of the speed issues for us. The other thing that we're doing is, as we move our applications to be more internet available, they can hit them from any access point, any wireless network, anything. So what it does from our perspective, it gives us the opportunity to tune our applications to work in a lot of places where latency is an issue or where just time is an issue. For example, some of our applications that we're running on the cloud are actually faster to run over a local internet connection or over a satellite link than it is to run either over AIDNet or over the State Department's network or anyone else's network, because they're just tuned more towards that capability.
And in fact, that was another one of your priorities from the last time we talked, was those lighter weight applications, less bandwidth. How many of those applications that you use regularly or mission critical applications are considered that lighter weight ones now?
I think maybe about half of our overall network application portfolio at this 5 seconds. The reality is that, you know, I was here 3 years ago, we were looking at the ability to start to move to the cloud. I think, you know, having Vivek Kundra, CIO for the federal government, and now Steve Van Roekel, it's given us an opportunity to really move a lot further than we expected to. So we've already moved to a web-based email system for a large part of our population that exists in, you know, sort of hard-to-reach places. We're starting to use a lot of lighter-weight applications, either tablet-based, smartphone-based, or even just web-based, that gives people access to systems in places now like Sudan, Afghanistan, places that where we try to reach our Foreign Service officers worldwide, they just don't have the latency or the bandwidth.
Is there a big change that you have to do as CIO to make sure those lightweight applications work? Or is it because now the cloud is everywhere, the vendors are coming to you with the, hey, if you want to put this on the cloud, we can make this lightweight, make it easier on you? Or do you have to go to the vendor and say, hey, this time and attendance application, can you make it more lightweight so it can run more easily on a tablet?
A little bit of the latter, although I would have to say a lot of the vendors of our old line applications haven't really stepped forward as fast as I would have hoped. But the fact that there are so many new cloud apps that are popping up, or new iOS or Android apps that are available to us, we're kind of sidestepping that issue. So it's a matter of availability for us. It's a matter of cost. You know, as we start to move to these lightweight apps, it makes it a lot less expensive for us to implement them and be able to provide them, you know, to our foreign service.
We've heard about, for instance, the Army doing an Apps for Army program where they ask soldiers to develop applications. And in fact, the idea came from soldiers in the field who have developed applications that, wow, those work really well. Have you guys done anything like that where maybe you've had some foreign service officers who's developed something that you say, wow, that could be easily spread to other places?
What we've really done is leverage some of their ideas. We had an environmental officer in South America who basically asked us for an application that would allow us to take pictures of environmental change, for example, glaciers over time, be able to take a picture, you know, track the GIS coordinates for that location, be able to track information about the projects that he's working on, be able to upload that back to a server, and then be able to map it and watch a photo montage or a movie over time to be able to watch a glacier receding, for example. So we tried to take a lot of these application ideas that our people have brought to us and either executed on them or tried to assist them in doing their own.
Do you find that Foreign Service officers and people in the field are tech savvy enough to do apps? Or obviously it depends on who it is, but a lot of times, you know, you have in the Army, for instance, use that as an example, you have the 18, 19, 20 year old servicemen and women who grew up on technology. While maybe you have a foreign service officer who is maybe, you know, more our age, and luckily on the radio, they can't see how old we are, but you get the point. They're maybe not as tech savvy or not as into doing the apps as maybe some of the younger people.
There's definitely a gradient there. I mean, I think there are some people even at my age, you know, old gray beard, that are starting to see the value of having an iPad or an Android tablet, for example, to be able to do these apps on. But I think, you know, in general, there's enough tech savvy people out there. And even if you look at the tech savviness as a bell curve, for example, you know, on the lower 25% that are very tech savvy, those are the ones that are starting to drive it. And I think as the maturity level and towards technology is maturing overall, people are more and more easy to understand how it works, makes it easy for people to be able to use. I think things like Facebook, the social apps, the iPads, we have a lot of people with personal iPads or iPhones or Androids who are actually more used to it, more capable with it than some of our own people are. So it's a wonderful revolution right now.
And it sounds like that may be one of your also priorities. So we're going to jump into that in just in a little bit. But before we do that, let's take a quick break. When we come back, there's one other priority that you talked about a number of years ago that I want to catch up with you on. But first, you're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today is Jerry Horton, the U.S. Agency for International Development's Chief Information Officer.
Share your home, change the world. Host a Youth for Understanding exchange student. Imagine welcoming a young person from Thailand, Japan, Germany, or one of 60 other countries into your family. Now everyday experiences take on a new and exciting twist. American traditions gain deeper meaning as you share them with your new son or daughter. Call 1-866-4-YFU-USA or visit the website at yfu-usa.org to learn how you can become a Youth for Understanding host family.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today is Jerry Horton, the U.S. Agency for International Development's Chief Information Officer. Now, Jerry, before break, we were talking a lot about your priorities that when you were last on the show 3 years ago. We talked a little bit about lighter weight applications, the changes to your network to make it easier for Foreign Service officers in the field. One of your other priorities was around an internal process to standardize how you do different IT functions, IT services. How are you doing down that path? Have you completed a lot of the standardization? Are you still working on it? Because one of the things that we've found is that IT standardization is one, never done, and two, never easy.
Oh, it's never done. I'll say that the overall process efforts that we've been going through is much like peeling an onion. And for every bad place we come to in an onion and we fix, there's like three or four more layers that we have to go through. So the problem with IT and information in general is that everything is so interrelated. You change one project, it has an effect on four or five or 10 others. So we have to make sure that as we peel every piece back and change every process, that we're not adversely affecting others. But I would say that, you know, a lot of the things we're doing on the process side is working towards more efficiency in our own internal processes, but also helping the agency. We've done a number of efforts with missions around the world where we've helped them do some process mapping, some process optimization. We've helped with a couple of major organizations here in Washington. We actually have another group, MPBP at USAID, who is doing a lot more of the process work in much more detail. So I think it's had a very positive effect on AID. But the thing that's really allowed us to do is work towards having, you know, much more efficiency as far as cutting our costs or looking at commodity IT operations. And that has really helped us get into the cloud, into virtualization, into other things.
You said the magic word. Well, you said two of them, actually: cutting costs and commodity IT. Give me a sense. Are you seeing a percentage savings? Did you baseline it a number of years ago, and now you say we're spending 20% less, 10% less?
I think we have our baselines, and we think we're cutting somewhere in the neighborhood of about 7% per year. It's hard to say in exact numbers, mainly because, you know, things change from year to year. But I would say that we're becoming more efficient. What it's really allowing us to do is be much more adaptable and much more, making it a lot easier for us to react to budgets as they change. In our case, you know, we really haven't seen the huge budget cuts that everybody's anticipating. But even in the uncertain nature, we want to make sure that as we cut the cost, we can also divert the funds to opportunities.
And that's something that you hear a lot from the Office of Management Budget. That's why the move to commodity IT, take from one part and put it into the commission part. How are you able to kind of make those changes around commodity IT? For instance, you talked about earlier a web-based email system. Is that for everyone or is it just for people in the field?
Right now, it's sort of in process. You know, we haven't really made the hard jump like GSA did or like some of the other agencies have done. We have about a third of our overall workforce have already made the move to web-based email. But what we anticipate that doing is saving is about $4 million a year or so. And that $4 million we've already started to reallocate to other applications, other processes. The biggest issue that we come across, though, is in our move to infrastructure as a service for our data center. We have one huge data center in the Reagan building. So cleaning that out has allowed us to, you know, save money in terms of real estate. You know, that's very expensive down there. But it's also made it a lot easier for us to move to a cloud-based infrastructure. What it's also done is it's freed up that space for other people to use. So they're actually starting to build a new center for environmental disasters or whatever, typical ops center.
So you took a data center and you're moving to Florida. Mm-hmm. Now, are you combining? There's a couple questions that I got to follow up with you with. So you're moving the data center to Florida. Are you going from five data centers to two, or is it the same one, but is it just a different setup because it's more virtualized and depends on different technology?
No, actually, kind of drove Vivek crazy when we were talking about this a couple of years ago as we started the migration. We're actually moving from one to three. So
I don't think OMB is going to appreciate that.
Well, actually, OMB at first, they were like, what? What are you doing? But the reality is they understand where we're headed. You know, two of those are basically virtual data centers. So again, we're cutting our overall costs. The issue we had at the beginning is we only had one data center. We had no disaster recovery. So the ability to move to a DR Coop type environment in the cloud has made it very easy for us. But the overall project is to cut our costs. It's one of those things about cloud. When I was the chair of the executive steering committee for cloud computing, you know, I always told people, why are you moving to the cloud if it's not going to save you money? And in this case, it's going to save us a lot of money, but it's also going to free up other aspects for us. Like I said earlier, it's going to decrease latency for a lot of our applications going overseas. It's going to make it very, very easy for us to do updates. And as infrastructure as a cloud service through this provider, we're basically moving from essentially what I call a GOCO, a government-owned contractor-operated facility, you know, inside our building, to essentially what is a COCO, contractor-owned, contractor-operated. But in this case, moving the services out has really cut our costs quite a bit.
It's very challenging to move to a COCO model, as you said. Talk a little bit about the service-level agreements you put in your contracts. Did you say the data must reside in the U.S.? Did you say you must have U.S. citizens always, you know, touching and handling the data? Well, because a lot of agencies are moving down that path, and I think since you've done it or are doing it, I think a little bit of lessons learned is always great.
Yeah, I mean, I think from our perspective, it's a little bit different because AID has facilities all over the world. So saying that information has to reside on U.S. soil doesn't always hold for us. So we couldn't really specify that, although we're trying to move as much as we can back into the States. I think the other aspect, though, is from our perspective, we wanted to make sure that they had classified people doing operations for us. So we make sure that everybody has a clearance, make sure that everybody has been processed. But the reality is that as information moves, from our perspective, overseas, it's really hard to say that it's all here in the States. The other things we've done, though, is we've actually upped our SLAs from our internal SLAs, in some cases 98, 95%, all the way up to, you know, say 3 nines, 4 nines, 5 nines. So it's actually given us an opportunity to make better inroads as far as operational activities, but it's also given us an opportunity to clean up our security models in a lot of areas. So we actually think we have better security than we had before, which is also an issue that we've done with our web-based email, with all of our other applications. As we do this, we're cutting costs, trying to increase efficiency, but also at the same time have better security.
It's interesting that you said at one time you had no disaster recovery. Did you have tapes? Like what did you do for backup? What happened if the Ronald Reagan building caught on fire? You know what I mean? Like what would you have done?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that because when I was working at Treasury, we had an organization that had their basement flooded, a block and a half away from us.
The IRS, right. I remember the flood, a major flood.
Yeah. So the IRS was basically out of that building for a number of months. If that had happened to AID, we probably would have stopped operations in Washington because we would not have been able to have our computer systems available. So from our perspective, getting this out and diversifying it gives us the DR, the Kook capabilities.
I know the Social Security Administration came under similar problems with their disaster backups. It was all based on tape, and they would have to move the tapes from one time to another. And the commissioner, I remember talking to him about this. He was saying, this is just, we need the new data center. We need the money for it. We need to do it, and we're building it. So I imagine it's a big relief for you guys as well to kind of develop that what-if factor, the Coop.
Oh, yeah, I actually get to sleep at night now. Because, I mean, it was one of the things you were thinking, oh, my gosh, what happens if that fails? And then we basically stop operations. But, again, the flip side is it's saving us money. When we're moving to a lot of our cloud applications, we're moving to a model where they provide, you know, obviously, direct storage, but also secondary storage, you know, essentially getting rid of the tape backups. And then we're also trying to model it where we have a tertiary backup system in case that cloud provider, whoever, for example, decides to go out of business, we still have the opportunity to go and move to someone else. So we're actually increasing our DR capabilities at the same time reducing our costs.
Where do you see the cost savings? Is it the fact is that you no longer have to have all that equipment?
Well, I think the reality is it's all in people. And what we're doing is we're migrating costs from our contracts here in Washington, having contract staff people on the ground, boots on the ground, for example, versus having a service provisioned system, say in Miami or with our email system or whatever. So basically we're getting out of having a lot of operators and administrators directly on staff as part of contract staff.
I think it's one area that people sometimes overlook at when you look at the cost for a data center is the contract staff, because it's rarely that it's government employees who are operating that contract, that data center. Let me switch over. You mentioned a lot of keywords during the first part of this conversation, mobility, cloud. Where are your priorities now when you look at over the next 6 or 9 months? What are you hoping to get done?
The biggest impact we have is our website. Our administrator has been pressing us very hard to do a complete overhaul. We're going back basically and cleaning up stuff that's 10, 15 years old. So it's a huge change for us, but it'll give us a state-of-the-art website going forward. And it also changes the way we try to interact with people. What I used to say is it was two government people talking to each other on our website. You know, the way the content was written and the way it read is now moving to basically being targeted at various constituencies, you know, the American people, congressional folks, the military, whomever. We've actually built personas around people that we're trying to target. So it basically gives us a chance to model our information and our content in a way that appeals to people better. Plus, it's giving an opportunity to upgrade and modernize our infrastructure. Basically, we're moving to, again, smartphone and tablet applications to be able to access information. Our digital clearinghouse for a lot of our information, our knowledge service center, for example, we're trying to make more available to people, anything that has public information in it, freely available.
And are you moving the whole website to the cloud, the whole idea of infrastructure as a service?
Actually, somewhat to the cloud, a little bit internal just because of the way our processes work inside. But again, it offers up a chance to be able to move fully to the cloud, you know, a year or two down the road. So I think the bigger issue for us is that it's, again, being able to cut our costs, but be able to have a new way of targeting our information, being able to sell AID, you know, tell our story better.
Very nice. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about some of your priorities. You're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today is Jerry Horton, the U.S. Agency for International Development Chief Information Officer.
As part of Sheehy Auto Store's annual campaign to support breast cancer awareness, the GW Mammovan will be on site at the Sheehy Ford and Nissan in Springfield on Thursday, June 28th from 9:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. Sheehy, in conjunction with the George Washington University Medical Faculty Associates, will offer free mammograms for those who don't have accepted health insurance coverage. Appointments are required. Call today to reserve your spot, 202-741-3252. That's 202-741-3252.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today is Jerry Horton, the U.S. Agency for International Development's Chief Information Officer. Now, Jerry, before break, we get into some of your newer priorities. You mentioned one big one was redoing the website. Give me a sense of some of the other things you're working on.
One of the other big priorities is what we term mobility. Now, I know this is a big topic among the government staff around town, but what we're looking for is a way to change what was a very static IT infrastructure within USAID to be a very open, very easy to access one. You know, our philosophy is that any device, any time. And, you know, we've been putting a lot of preference on, you know, being able to access and support all of our systems and services through personal devices as well as government furnished equipment. And that is a huge change from a lot of people's perspective because, you know, we are still a federal agency. We have to follow all the guidelines, all the rules, and we try to be better than the baseline. So, but being able to do that in a way that allows people to use a personal iPad, for example, has really opened up a lot of our services. So from that perspective, certainly the cloud move for our TCOC or our data center move, opening up access, virtualization, being able to get access to applications and services to the desktop or to a laptop or a tablet. We're putting in wireless infrastructures around the world right now. We have, I think, 12 missions around the world, plus some major sections of the Washington facility that are completely wireless. And then at the same time, you know, trying to build a better security model. You know, we've been very perimeter-based for forever. And I could tell you about all the stories back from, you know, when I was with Motorola or whatever, but nothing's really changed as long as you're in a perimeter-based security model. So we're trying to add on to that element-level encryption, being able to do tagging, being able to do things so people have authentication. But all of this, all the IT infrastructure that we're doing as a change is really around the way we access information.
One of the things you brought up was the idea of personal iPads. Are you, do you guys have a BYOD, a bring your own device model or policy yet, or a pilot program even?
More of a pilot program, I would say. We don't really have a formal policy on it, mainly because it's such a hard thing to be able to provide. But with some of the things we're doing, say as you move to a web-based email system, if you provide proper three-factor authentication to people, which we're doing, it doesn't matter what device, as long as there's no artifacts left on that device. Now, the issue there is that if you're going to download to your email application on your iPad, for example, you can't do that on a personal device. It all has to be very web-based, very cleanable. So from the perspective of not having any artifacts, you could actually access any system. And what we're trying really hard to do is not replicate the typical PC desktop on a device, but actually leverage the capabilities of those devices, you know, either through apps specifically or through web-based access.
You mentioned three-factor authentication. I've definitely heard two-factor, obviously, like a username and password. What is the third factor you guys are requiring?
Actually, it is two-factor. You know, back from my days in private industry, it was always called three because it's your name, what you know, and what you have.
So the what you have is the device in this one.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if you were like adding the HSPD 12 card reader or something, a fingerprint, you know, those laptops that you could put your fingerprint on and get you in there.
We've been looking at a lot of those, and I think the HSPD 12 movement will start to pick up some steam over the next year or so. But as we do that, through tokens, through smart tokens, you know, on devices themselves, we can even do that on a personal device now. So it makes it a lot easier for people to access. I can log into my email system within about 7 or 8 seconds. So it's a very, very fast application and very, very simple, as opposed to having to try to load a Citrix-based or a VMware-based system that's a VPN and you have to load a complete desktop and takes like 5 to 10 minutes. I could be on and off within a minute.
And I think that part of what people are going to with their own devices with that idea of the mobile is that ability to at least get email, to get calendar, to get some of the basic stuff. It sounds like that's what you guys are doing. How big of a pilot are we talking about? Are we talking about a few hundred people?
Well, I would say on the use of personal devices, it's kind of as an ad hoc. You know, we've had a number of people, probably about 20 to 25 of our executives, plus maybe another 300 or 400 people around the world that have had personal devices they want to access. Well, that requires the move to a web-based email system because our old system wouldn't really work for them. It requires authentication. It requires, you know, a little bit of work from our perspective. But I think it makes it a lot easier for them. And, you know, if you're sitting in a coffee bar in, you know, Central Africa, or if you're sitting in a shop in Delhi, India, you can still access it very, very quickly, you know, through whatever mechanism is possible. So, you know, one of my favorite things is that I like to tell people that I have my office on my back. I literally have an iPad or a laptop that I carry with me, and I have my smartphone. I don't have a desktop phone anymore. I don't have a desktop computer anymore. Basically, my office is wherever I am.
And I think that's the goal of so many agencies, just to, it's not, you know, where you work. It's what you do when you do work and how you work. I mean, the General Services Administration has been talking about the mobile office, and I think the way you just described it is the future for a lot of people in government. Another priority you talked about, give me a sense of something else you wanted to try to accomplish.
Well, I think the biggest one for us is information management. I walked into a great situation with AID where we have a new procurement system that just came online fully. We've rolled it out worldwide now. We have a really good financial system. A lot of our other systems are in place, so we can start to link those. We're actually starting to move information back and forth from what we call our systems of record and be able to mash it in a way that people can use to make decisions. We have a really great application right now that's being rolled out to missions that allows them to track the portfolio. You know, and that includes everything from the projects they're working on to the GIS coordinates of where those projects are, to the actual performance information around those projects.
This sounds very similar to what OMB is asking around portfolio stat. Now, is there a relationship there where you're saying, okay, here's the line of business that we're in, and here's all the data points around it?
No, this is more from our perspective. As my boss likes to say, we need to follow the money. and be able to track it completely through the projects and the performance of those projects. So it gives us a level of transparency that we haven't really had before. So, you know, I was kind of applauding, you know, Steve Van Roekel's whole concept of portfolio stat. And I think it's a great opportunity for us to be able to really track and manage these. But from our perspective, it's really tracking our own information. And the nice thing from our perspective also is that all this information flows from one system to another automatically. There's no duplication of data entry. There's no, you know, mistakes being made. Everything flows in one direction.
What about business analytics and business intelligence? Are you starting to apply some of those technologies on top of all this data?
We have several great BI opportunities coming. We're just not quite there yet. But the ability to be able to use our information to say, oh, well, we've built this road in this section of this country. If we decided to build another road in another part of the country, what are all the dynamics, the context for where to build that road? So all that information is there. It's just a matter of being able to use it now.
Do you foresee going out with, for instance, an RFP or look at industry for these tools? Or do you have maybe some tools that are being used on a small scale within AID that will maybe be expanded?
Strangely enough, we have all the tools. And all the systems are there to be able to exchange information between systems. So it makes it really easy for us. It's just a matter of our own being able to execute according to being able to move that information around.
Agencies are really facing this big data issue, the data overload. It's not new. We've heard about it for years. But I think with the cloud and then the systems becoming easier to integrate, like you just said, your procurement, your financials, okay, how do we deal with all this data? Are you feeling that same type of problem where it's the data overload?
It's a matter of understanding what information you need out of the system. And I would say that AID, like most government agencies, is not quite fully there yet, although we're getting there. But once you start to have it, you know, hopefully people can start to make sense of it. You know, a lot of it is sort of superfluous. A lot of it doesn't really matter to our day-to-day operations, but the pieces that does, either from the perspective of telling our story better, because a lot of people don't know what we do and don't see the actual implementation of a lot of our projects, all the way to the people actually making decisions of which projects to go forward with. So, you know, I think that information is all there. It's a matter of our understanding how we need to use it in a logical way.
All right, very good. Unfortunately, we're out of time. It sounds like we could talk much longer, but we'll have to have you back on sooner than 3 years, I promise. You've been listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today was Jerry Horton, the U.S. Agency for International Development Chief Information Officer. Jerry, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Ask the CIO, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, WFED, your source for federal news now.